How would you rank your life satisfaction on a scale of 1 to 10? Is it related to how much money you have? Because here's the thing, it was thought that income didn't have a whole lot to do with happiness, which is an idea that nearly all of us could feel good about. But this now appears to be wrong. Happiness, life satisfaction, and how they relate to income are our topics today on Rightside Economics with Professor Andrew Lee from the Australian National University. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning, Richard.
What about you? How would you rate your life satisfaction?
Well, Richard, I'm just about to go on holiday with a family, so I would rate myself a 9 out of 10.
Wow.
Maybe on a bad day I'd be down on an 8, but I'm normally up the top of the scale. How about you? Where would you put yourself?
2. No. I think 7. Let's say 7.
Okay. So you're a little below average. The typical Australian is 7.8, I think, on this scale. So I'm a smidgen above and you're a smidgen below average.
To be fair, Andrew, I did not know it was possible to have decimal points within the scale. I may have adjusted my answer. I don't know. All right. Well, what about, you're off to Vietnam. What's their happiness, life satisfaction rating over there?
So Vietnam is a sort of middle-income country, which comes in somewhere around 5 to 6 on the 0-10 happiness scale. Not as bad as some of the African countries, which where average happiness levels are between 3 and 4, for example, in a place like Zimbabwe, but not as good as the more affluent countries like Australia, the US, the Scandinavians, where the average is above 7.
But we used to think, until quite recently, that rich countries were no happier than poor ones. And this is called the Easterlin paradox. Can I just get you to explain that?
In 1974, Richard Easterlin wrote what is possibly one of the most important papers in social science. And he was trying to look at the differences in happiness and how they related to differences in income. He's able to show 3 particular findings. Firstly, he can show that within any country he looks at, rich people are happier than poor people. So there's a within-country difference. Secondly, he looks at the data that's then available to him, and it doesn't look to him as though the average happiness level in a rich country is any higher than the average happiness level in a poor country. Part of the issue there is that he doesn't have that much data on happiness, and most of the observations are actually from pretty rich countries. So he's sort of comparing pretty small differences there. And then thirdly, he looks at the data and it seems to suggest to him that as countries grow richer over time, they don't appear to become any happier. And Japan and the US are the key countries for which he has data.
Right. Now, so this paper went on to shape thinking on this issue for decades.
Absolutely. It has a huge literature comes out of this. People then start to explore why this should be the case. There's a discussion of the hedonic treadmill in which you put yourself on a treadmill of consumption. You keep on consuming and consuming, but that rising income doesn't buy you anything else. And at the beginning of this year, Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers, 2 researchers at the University of Pennsylvania, say, well, we've gotten a whole heap more data now. It used to be when Easterlin was doing these studies, we only had a handful of countries. Now Gallup has gone out into over 100 countries and surveyed life satisfaction. We have very nice time series for a range of different countries. So they basically say, let's go back and reanalyze the data and see if the Easterlin paradox holds up. So firstly, they look at the within-country effect, and they say, yes, absolutely, it's true that within a country, the rich are happier than the poor. Then they look across countries, and they say, well, actually, it looks like across countries, the average happiness level in a rich country is higher than the average happiness level in a poor country, and the slope is about the same. That is, a 10% increase in income buys you some more happiness within your country, and a 10% increase in your country's income buys that country about the same level of average happiness. And then they go to the time series and they say within most of the countries for which they're able to observe, most of the European countries, the Japanese countries, when they carefully reanalyze the data, it appears that rising incomes have led to rising happiness. The one exception is the US. They score that one for Easterlin. The US has increased its GDP per capita over time, but its average levels of happiness have not gone up.
Okay, so I just want to recap to make sure I'm on the same page as you, Andrew. They have found, these 2 researchers at the University of Pennsylvania, that rich people are happier than poor people, and that rich countries are happier than poor countries, and that this holds except across the United States.
That's right. And their best guess as to what's going on in the United States is that much of the income gains have actually not gone to the typical household. They've gone to the top of the distribution. So if you look at the income gains of the typical household in the last 30 years in the US, they're very, very modest. So they say, you know, maybe that explains why average happiness levels in the US haven't gone up.
On Life Matters today, in Rightside Economics, which we're doing a day early, actually, this time, my guest is Andrew Lee, Professor of Economics at the Australian National University. We're talking about money and happiness. And, we've been exploring what is a relatively new paper published earlier this year, came out of the University of Pennsylvania, which challenges the Easterlin paradox. Now, you may not have heard of the Easterlin paradox, but you've heard of the idea that essentially money doesn't buy happiness, that once you get to a certain level of income, you don't keep getting any happier. And Andrew, has that part of the thinking been challenged? That actually, it's understandable that money buys you certain happiness. If you're very poor and you get some money, then you can have an improvement in your quality of life. But beyond a certain measure, I suppose you get diminishing returns. Has that been challenged?
That's certainly been challenged as well, Richard. And so Betsy and Justin in their new analysis go through and look at this, challenge the contention that when a country's average income level gets to, say, $15,000 a year, additional money doesn't buy them any more happiness. And they say, no, that doesn't seem to be consistent with the data. It appears that money buys you more happiness as you continue to go up the scale. In fact, if anything, the gradient seems to steepen a little towards the top of the distribution, not flatten out. And so, again, it seems that moving from an income level of, say, Portugal to an income level of Denmark does buy you more happiness.
This is really important, isn't it? Because, and I don't know if anyone else has replicated their work yet, but if they're right, it means that economic development and rising incomes are actually more important than we've thought.
That's right, and suggests that actually if you're worried about increasing life satisfaction, GDP is not that bad a proxy. We used to think, based on the Easterlin paradox, that our country's average income was a very poor proxy for the sort of deep well-being. And these researchers argue, well, the reason that higher incomes seem to buy more happiness is that they expand the choice set for people. So people are then better able to choose how much they want to work, services they can consume, what particular products they can have, and that expansion of choice really seems to ensure higher levels of life satisfaction. Gallup also, in this wonderful survey they've done looking at more than 100 countries around the world, includes some other little interesting questions like, how often did you smile today? Did you experience physical pain today? Were you treated with respect today? And all of those measures, which I think we would regard as proxies for well-being, track average income in a country.
It's interesting, this, because it's a kind of return to what makes intuitive sense, isn't it? I mean, if you ask an 8-year-old, does having more money make you happier? They're going to say, yes, of course it does. And I suppose that's what we've thought, except for the last 30 years.
Indeed, yes. So it's a little sad thing when a fascinating paradox gets knocked down. But I think it does return to something that seems, as you say, more intuitive to an 8-year-old.
Now, one of the other things that the researchers at in Philadelphia looked at was women. It turns out that women are less happy than they were 30 years ago.
That's absolutely right. And so what's striking about this is that so many of the technological and legal shifts of the last couple of decades have worked in favour of women. This is not to say that on every measure women are equal to men in every sphere. But if you think about the major shifts in discrimination law, in the way in which the labour market operates, particularly the technological shifts, women historically have done the lion's share of housework. And so all of these sort of large technological shifts around washing machines, vacuum cleaners, microwaves have put a whole lot of extra time back into the pockets of women. If it had been the case that men were doing the housework, then those huge technological shifts would have greatly advantaged men. But given that women were doing much of the housework, these technological shifts really matter. And so on just about any sort of objective measure you can think of, women seem to have become better off over this period. But Wolfers and Stevenson are again able to show that when they look within the US, there seems to have been a happiness gap that's opened up. In the early 1970s, women were the happier sex. By the early 2000s, men are the happier sex. It's true not just in the United States, but also across the European countries they're able to analyse.
Now, do they have any inkling as to why this is?
Well, this is what's interesting about the paper, and having just shot down one paradox, they aim to pose their own. They're pretty careful to say that the data do not point strongly to a particular explanation. So they break down changes in happiness across different groups. If you thought, for example, that this was something to do with the changes in the employment structure of women, then you would see differences in employed and not employed women. And you don't see that. The happiness gap goes in the same direction for both. The happiness gap goes in the same direction for married and unmarried women, for women with children, women without, for older women and for younger women. So it seems that as a group, women have steadily drifted away from men in the happiness stakes.
How reliable is all this, Andrew? Because as you say, this research has come out this year. Some of it has made a very big splash. You could argue, I imagine, that some of it's rather subjective.
Certainly life satisfaction is subjective, but I think that's why people have liked it, in the sense that it allows us to sum up a broad range of characteristics. So, for example, when you asked me about my life satisfaction before, I had in mind not only how happy I am with my family and my income, but also the holiday that I'm anticipating. And it would be difficult to think of another question which so effectively sort of brings together the things that are important to the responder. So there's a real value in that question, although there's sort of a little bit more fuzziness as to how we pin it down.
All right, Andrew. Well, it's been really interesting as always, and have a great holiday.
Thank you, Richard.
See you in a fortnight. That is Andrew Lee, Professor of Economics at the ANU. We'll have him back in 2 weeks for more Ryside Economics. And actually, what do you think? How would you rate your life satisfaction on a scale of 1 to 10? And I'll tell you now, you can use decimal points. So, but perhaps just one decimal point rather than going into the, say, 7.23 kind of level. Get in touch via the guest book, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters, or give us a ring, 02 833 14 30.